So I've got a few minutes left before the scheduled start time, and so one of the things I like to do with this is play a game called Stump the Chump. So I've been working, I'm one of the core developers on MongoDB, and I've been there for, it's going to be 4 years next month, actually. So if any of you have any questions about MongoDB, particularly hard ones, hence the name Stump the Chump, feel free to ask them. First off, have any of you used MongoDB? Okay, good handful. Do you have any questions?
Are you gonna, you were first.
Is it keeping a lot of the data structures in memory?
The question was, do we keep data structures in memory, just indexes? And the answer is, we keep as much as we can in memory. In fact, we actually let the kernel handle that because, you know, people that have been developing Linux have been working on advanced memory management technology and, you know, algorithms for a very long time, and they have a lot of experience doing it, and they tend to do a good job. And so essentially the way it works is that the most frequently and the most recently used, the algorithm that they use takes into combination those two factors. And so the most frequently and the most recently used data will be in memory. So for most applications that will tend to include the indexes, and it will also include some subset of your hot data. But one of the interesting things is, because of the structure, the tree structure of an index, it's entirely possible that you don't need the entire index in memory. So let's say that you're doing a time-based index. You know, you imagine the tree, you've got the old stuff over here and the new stuff over here. Most sites don't have as much access over their old data. So it turns out that you actually only need to keep this right-hand sliver of the index in memory, and so that memory that was holding the older data in index could be better spent on holding data rows and caching that. So the algorithms actually tend to take that into account.
Newbie questions, but you're talking about or validating structures.
I could, but that's an entire hour talk. So since we're here to talk about aggregation, I won't be. Sorry. All right, so we're now at, according to my clock, 11. So I'll go ahead and get started. So as I said, I'm one of the old guys at 10Gen. Got to get used to saying MongoDB now. as of a little over a year ago, I actually took over the aggregation project. And I've been working on it pretty much full-time ever since. So this is kind of, I've been living in this world for a while. I've been thinking about it, and I must say it's a lot of fun to work with. And one of the interesting things about it is that we took a very different approach to how you do aggregations than in a relational database. In fact, how many of you have used Linux? That's what I thought. So. And, you know, you've used the command line, I take it, and so you know what a pipe is. And so we're used to working that model. And so we thought that's a very powerful model. You know, you take your data set. Now, in the command line, you're typically working with lines of text. And so you take your data set, and you run it through a couple of very simple tools. You know, grep, while it's, you know, there are some complicated things for regular expression, in reality, it's a fairly simple tool. It's just designed to say, keep this, don't keep that. It's kind of an inclusion-exclusion filter. You know, sorts data. And while these simple tools can't do much by themselves, where you really get the power is you pipe them together. So you take the output from one, send it into the next. You know, how many of you have written a pipeline that had at least 10 programs in it? You know, you start with something that can't do much of anything, and you end up doing something crazy complex. I once wrote a kind of a reverse parser and automatic editor for some crazy SE Linux configuration file out of bash and a little bit of vim script that would, you know, run through, find all the files that depended on something, and, you know, ended up doing the edit for me, essentially, all with these little tiny tools. So because we recognize the power of this pipelining concept, and that's what we built our aggregation system on top of. So this should feel fairly familiar. So as I said, we have a bunch of fairly simple tools, but the real power is in combining them. So just to, I'll do a quick run through of the tools. Quick question, how many of you really like slideshows with bulleted lists? Good, I don't use them. I much prefer live demos. Hopefully you will too. But bear in mind, this is like my third Mountain Dew, so I'm a little jittery, so bear with me if I typo a little bit. All right, so talking about the stages of the pipeline, are essentially like the executables in a Linux pipeline. So the simplest one is match, and it will let you say include or exclude these rows based on some criteria. So I would say it's roughly the equivalent of a grep. So the data set we're going to be looking at today is a zip code database. So the information that we have is the city, the state, the population of the, and this is specifically of the zip code, what the zip code is, and the location. So this is the geographic point for this zip code. Obviously, a zip code isn't quite a point, but this is some definition of centroid. So as an example, using the match, the simplest match is going to be an exact match. So ID is, and this is my zip code. So this is just simply going to find my zip code. So this is filtering through the entire collection and finding the one zip code that is mine. you can also do more complicated things like where the find zip codes where the population is greater than, say, 100,000. And there are a few. So there's only, what is that, four zip codes where the population is greater than 100,000. So you can use this, and this is the same way that you would use grep in a Linux pipeline. Next up is sort. Anyone want to hazard a guess of what sort does? Yes, good guess. Sort sorts. It is equivalent to the Unix command sort. Just as an example, of these, let's say I wanted to sort them . So the way this works is, as I said, bear with me as I typo. There we go. So sort takes a list of fields and a direction, one being ascending, meaning the first thing is going to be the lowest, and the last thing is going to be the highest, or descending, where the first is the highest and the last is the lowest. So as an example, so this shows Chicago is the, has the largest zip code with 312,000, and New York has one just over 100. If I reverse it, you know, as you'd expect, it does what you would expect. You can also add other, you can add other parameters, so like if I wanted to say sort by state and then within a state sort by population, you can do that as well. So fairly simple.
How does it maintain ordering the dictionary? You just pass through the hash of ordering by field. How does it maintain the order between those fields?
Good question. I was wondering, since we're passing in a hash, namely state and pop are two fields of a hash table or a JavaScript object, how do we maintain the order so it knows that it's state first and not population? And the way that works is JavaScript actually does maintain the order of fields. It's actually an insert preserving. So for example,
well, that works in JavaScript, but it doesn't work in, say, Python.
Correct. So in Python, we actually have a special type called son, which is an ordered dict. You can also pass in collections.ordered dict. However, to feel more natural in the language, you usually don't have to worry about that detail. The Python language actually takes it in as a list of tuples or a list of lists. So for languages that don't offer order preserving hashes, we have an alternate API. One of the goals of Mongo is to feel native in each language. We don't want to feel like, for example, with SQL, where you're kind of writing strings that are inside of another language. It's supposed to feel like you're writing actual code in the language you're working in. All right, so as I said, sort sorts, limit limits. It's equivalent to head with some number. So for example, let me just go ahead and clear this out. Typically what you're going to do is you're going to combine it with a sort. So what this will do is sort with the largest zip codes at the beginning and then take the first three. So again, these are the three largest zip codes. If I wanted, I could reverse this, and I've got the three smallest, namely, they're empty. Excuse me. One thing to note is that while this is supposed to be logically a pipeline, unlike with the Unix pipeline, where each process is completely independent and doesn't know about what its input or output program is, we actually do have knowledge of the entire pipeline. And so we can say, hey, you're doing a sort followed by a limit, which means that we don't actually need to sort all of the data. So for example, if you had a 10 gigabyte file, you typically wouldn't want to run that through sort just to take the head of one. This is why sort has a parameter to let you limit the number of output size. Whereas we don't actually need that because we can analyze the pipeline and say, hey, you're only looking for the top result. We can, rather than doing a full sort and then just throwing away most of it and taking the first result, we can say, well, I'll just keep the best one around and keep, you know, are you better than that? If not, throw it out. If so, replace. And we can actually do that for any sort of a limit. So frequently you do want to combine sorts and limits.
Is there any sort of middleware layer for doing your own optimization? I would imagine the most common one, but it's a very similar problem to like a compiler, where there is a nearly infinite set of possible optimizations.
So we don't have a kind of built-in middleware layer, if that's what you're describing, but one of the nice things about this, typically this can also be passed in as an array. This is really just shorthand for the array form. And if you read this, it looks an awful lot like a data structure. So one of the things I always like to mention is that really this is data that you're sending to the server that describes what you want it to do. You're not sending it some textual code. You're working with objects you can manipulate in your native language. So you are free to take this object and manipulate it yourself.
So just do the optimization in the query itself, right?
Correct. Now, that said, you may not be able to do better than what we can do. So don't go too far down that rabbit hole. We may already be doing it. For example, I'll often see people adding, kind of taking the fields that they need and selectively including them. But we already do that for you. You don't even need to say, these are the fields I'm going to use. If you are, in particular, actually, probably the wrong point to bring this up because I haven't shown any that actually use only a subset of the fields. But when I get to group and project, they know all of the fields that they're going to use a priori. They know right when you start, before they even process their first piece of data, which fields they're going to need. So you don't even need to say which fields you need to select out of your original data. It'll automatically do that for you and only use those pieces of data. So in general, I wouldn't worry about it, is the full response. Yeah?
Just curious, do you change your algorithm based on the entire set of arguments? For example, a sort with a limit I probably implement internally as a key sort, while without a limit I might use
yes.
Sort of something
Yes, there's actually three in-memory algorithms that we choose between, namely the limit of 1, which is just a special case, limit of k, so then we do a heap, and for unlimited, we have a just take all the data and sort it. And then we also have, for the latter two, we also in 2.6, this is new for 2.6 and what I was working on about a month ago, we also support spilling to disk. So if you know you have a terabyte data set that you want to sort, we can actually do that by spilling it to disk and doing a merge sort over those files. And even if you had a 10 gigabyte data set of which you wanted the top gigabyte, but you didn't want to fit that in, do that all in memory, we can also do that again using the same algorithm. So there's actually a set of 5 different algorithms that would get used depending on data set size and your limit. It's a lot of fun to work on, by the way. All right, so skip does exactly what you would expect as well. So I'll just tack it on to the end. So right now we have, I'm not even sure how to pronounce that, Allen and Shvac. If I we still have Shvac and Allen, but we don't have the one I could not pronounce. You know, these do exactly what you would expect. It's always nice to show that it actually does work, and I'm not just making this up. So now we're getting into some of the more interesting ones. Project is, you can think of it similar to the way that you typically would use a sed. The idea of project is it lets you take an input object of one type and either and reshape the document. You can also do some computed expression. So let's go back to the biggest three. That way they're non-zero. And let's say I wanted to include, sure.
On that last query, you did limit 3 and then skip 1. You actually got 2 results.
Yes.
Which is somebody visiting something different.
Correct. Well, so actually, this is
because it's ordered.
Correct. Yes. So if I did skip 1, limit 3, that is different from limit 3, skip 1. And that's also something that we rearranged to be more optimal. So going back to this, so let's say I did project where so this is saying I want the where field to be an object which has city and state, which are populated with the city and state fields of the input. And I also want pop square to be dollar multiply of population times population. Now, this is obviously just an example, not something you would actually want to do, but it is possible, just to show. So this is the squared population of this zip code in Chicago. And you can see that it actually allows you to reshape the document and select which fields you want, which fields you don't, things like that. You can also say include specific fields by just adding 1 or true, which pulls the field in directly. So that's project. There's a whole ton of operators. New ones are coming in 2.6, including a bunch of set operators. So you can do things like, if you have 2 arrays, you can say, give me the intersection or the union of these 2 arrays. You can do set difference, test for subsetness. I don't remember all of them, but we have a long list of operators, and it's growing continuously. So that's project. So GeoNear is similar to, let me just clear this all out. What GeoNear is essentially saying is find things near a given point. So the way it works is you give it a point to be near. And in fact, I'm going to use this point, which is where I'm standing at the moment. I looked this up last night. And one of the things you have to tell it is distance. And what it will do is it will actually inject the distance from that point into the output document. So let's say I want to call that distance. And it implicitly has a limit of 100, but you can actually override that and give it your own limit. And let's just say I want the 5 closest zip codes. So these are the 5 closest zip codes to where I'm sitting right now. And in fact, I did check, this is the zip code of this building. Now, you may be wondering, what units are these distances in? By default, they are in the units of the input. And if you looked at the input, you would see that they're in degrees, which is a rather useless input. And in fact, it uses flat math, which is, of course, inaccurate. And so if you want more accuracy, which who doesn't, you can tell it to use spherical math. So this is actually taking, if I were to go across the Earth rather than looking on a map and using a ruler, how long would it take, or what's the distance between these two points on the actual Earth as the crow flies? So these are in potentially even less useful units of radians, which has the advantage that it doesn't piss off either Americans or Europeans. It also has the advantage that it's very easy to convert out of. So as an example, one of my nice Google hacks is that if you Google for radius of the Earth in miles, and this also works if you choose to Google for radius of the Earth in cubits, I don't know if you're building pyramids or something, it actually does many different units, because Google's kind of fun like that. But you can then hop in here and say, distance multiplier. And now you've got miles. So apparently the centroid of this zip code is about a third of a mile from where I'm standing. And I believe this building is at least a third of a mile long, so that kind of makes sense. And the nearest zip code is 1.6 miles away. And again, because this is actually injected into this field, it's now available in the next stage of the pipeline. So you could do other operations with the distance. So that's GeoNear. Group is where we start to kind of get away from what can easily be represented in a command line. Now, I've often used awk for this, but it's a bit of an advanced usage of awk. But you know, it does kind of what the name implies. It groups things and lets you do, this is where it actually starts to do aggregation. Previously, it's been mostly about working with individual rows. Group is where we actually aggregate these rows together. So the way this works is you specify an ID, which is the thing that you want to group on. Everything with the same ID will then end up being grouped into the same output record. So to start with, I will use the state. And then I will switch over. Let's say I wanted to get the population of the state. To do that, I would do sum of the population of the zip code. States are nothing more than the sum of their parts. So these are the states and their population. You can also get a count by doing sum of one. So this actually can take any expression, and what it will do is it will just add it once for each row that's input for that group. So this is equivalent to doing a count. So Florida has 826 zip codes for about 12 million people. In addition, there are some other ones that you can do, like average of the population. And that gives you the average zip code size in each state. So kind of obvious what each of these do. In 2.6, we'll probably be adding standard deviation if you want to do more statistics, along with we currently in 2.2 and 2.4, we currently have push to add things to an array, add to set, which is like push but doesn't add if it is if it's already in the array, and there's a few others. So now we're getting into unwind, and unwind doesn't have any equivalent that I know of. It's something that's very easy to understand, but very hard to write down a very short description of. So what unwind does, and I use a different data set for showing this, because this is Linux Fest, I'm going to use distros. And before I do this, I just want to say, because I know this can be a contentious subject, the opinions expressed here are my personal opinions and not the opinions of my employer, MongoDB Inc., or any other entity. And with that out of the way, Arch Linux is by far the best distribution, and you should all be running it. So I've got wrote this up, and this is a collection of distributions. So Arch Linux is awesome, and it's a Linux distribution. Ubuntu is crap. It's Linux, but it's relatively new. Red Hat is also crap. It's also Linux, but it's one of the older ones. It's seasoned, if you will. FreeBSD is a BSD, and it's, hell, it's even older than that. So Minix, I don't actually know anything about, so I don't know. Now, as you can see, these are in an array. And to actually kind of work with this, sometimes you need to break up that array. And that's exactly what unwind does. What it does is it takes this array and replaces it with each element in the array. So you'll see that each document will be emitted once per field, per element in the array. So if I scroll back up, you can see that Arch Linux got emitted twice, once for each of its nodes. Ubuntu and Red Hat were each emitted three times. FreeBSD was emitted twice. And Minix wasn't emitted at all because there was nothing to emit. So this is a way to kind of take your data and break up these arrays so that you can work with them more piecemeal. Sure. One of the things that it doesn't do is let you go across collections. So I would hesitate to call it a join, but you would use it in many of the same ways that you would use a join, because a lot of the times things that you would in SQL model as separate collections, for example, the tags on a blog post or the list of parts in a bill of materials or the list of line items in a purchase order. These are all things that you would typically represent instead in Mongo as a single array embedded in the outer document. So while the use case is often the same, it's a little different. So now, as I keep going back to and will continue to repeat, the real power here is that you can combine this, just as the power of a command line and the fact that you can type something and run it, is the power that you can take the output from one program and pipe it into a next. So really, unwind by itself isn't all that useful. But what it lets you do is you can now group on notes and push it onto and you can now push it onto an array. So you can now see that that the BSDs include FreeBSD. These are the old things. This is the new thing. These are crap. These are all Linuxes, or Linuxes? I don't know. And this is awesome. So this is essentially doing a pivot table. It kind of gives you a way to take your data and flip it around and look at it in a different way. So one of the things that used to be said before we introduced this project about non-relational databases is they're great until you need to do a report, until you need to analyze your data. But so now we've been able to take this and allow you to reshape your data into what you need to do your reporting. Any questions so far? Cool. While I am brave enough to do a live demo, I'm not brave enough to do a live demo using Git Master. So I will just describe the next two. These are things that are coming that we actually just finished. But I am not brave enough to do a live demo using Git Master. So dollar out is something that's been wanted for a while, and it's always been planned. We just haven't gotten around to it until this release. And it's essentially equivalent to arrowing to a file. What it does is it allows you to specify a collection, take the output. As you can see, the output is currently in objects. Wouldn't it be great if you could write those objects to a collection? Now you can. It's equivalent to, insert into select or the equivalents. It can also be used, in a sense, to build a materialized view. So one of the use cases that's now available is, let's say that you have your summary table that you use for doing kind of live views of your reporting, and you only need to update it once a day after, updating your main table. So what you can do is you can fire off this aggregation job with a dollar out. And what it will do is when it's done, it will atomically replace the collection with the updated version. So that way you can continue to do your queries against the initial collection, or against the reporting collection. And as soon as the new data is available, it will be available to your reports. And we also added Redact. This was for some of our larger customers, and they wanted some sort of way to do ACLs of field level data. So this allows you to kind of specify tags on your data and say, for this specific row, only people with these attribute tags are able to view it. If you're in any, large company with complex security requirements, this is useful. If you're not, you probably have absolutely no use for this. So in reality, that's basically it. That's that is all of the pieces that we have. And I didn't go into detail on all of the, sub-expressions or all of that, but these are the big concepts. But now, to get the real use out of it, you start to combine them. So, going back here, this gave the who is it? Just kidding. So, what this does, as I showed earlier, this little pipeline, or this little unit of a pipeline, will go through and give you the state level data. So we started with zip codes. Now we've got whole states. We've combined them. You can also group into smaller entities like cities. Yeah. too many Mountain Dews. So these are all of the cities in the US, at least the ones that have zip codes associated with them. Most of that time was actually spent in JavaScript trying to print it. But these are all of the zip codes. These are all of the cities. So what we can do is we can now, let's say I want to get the biggest city, sort by population descending, so biggest first. And I want to get the biggest, let's just say 3. So these are the 3 biggest cities. Chicago, this data set actually breaks New York City up into several constituent cities. So this has Brooklyn next and Los Angeles as the 3rd largest. I should mention this data is actually out of date. I've been using this for a few years and it was already a little out of date then. If you look at the most recent, so there's an old saying one of my professors in computer science used to say is garbage in, garbage out. So if you don't have accurate data coming in, obviously we can't give you accurate data coming out. These are accurate as of the data that was put in, but if you were to go onto Wikipedia and look for the largest cities in the US, obviously this is not going to correlate exactly. So this now gives you the largest cities. So now what I can do is group these cities into states. So remember, the output from one is the input to the next. So if I want to group by state, it's now id.state, because it's not getting the raw input, it's getting the grouped input. So excuse me. So this now gives you, again, the states. Now, we already had this. You could have gotten that out of the original data directly by just grouping on states. But what this now enables us to do is to say, gotta resize my window. What this enables us to do now is we can actually give you the average city size . So, because we grouped them into cities, we're now taking the average of the population of the cities to get their average size. So that's what you can do because you're taking them in order. Now, the reason I left that sort in there is because it lets us do other interesting things. For example, we can say biggest city name. And that's going to be the first, because we're sorting with biggest first. And the biggest city size is the first population. So, as you would expect, the biggest city in Illinois is Chicago, with, as of this data, 2.4 million people. And that is larger than the average city of 10,000. So I kind of like to describe this as kind of having a conversation with your data. You know, you get your data and you say, well, you know, I wonder, you know, I have this piece. What can I get next? You know, this is kind of interesting. So now, as you can see, this is kind of spread out over four lines, getting a little unmanageable. One of the things that you can do So now I've got it here. You can actually read it a little bit easier. So just to go through it again, we've got the grouping into cities, sorting by population, and then grouping again on the state. One of the other things that you can do is you can edit it in a proper editor, which the only proper editor is Vim. So in addition to the biggest, I can also get the smallest. And of course, that will be the last. And so I can now pass that in. And the smallest city in Illinois is Anconia. Now, again, we can also, you know, say, let's say we're interested, since we're in Ohio. Might as well use an example with Ohio. So we can now see Ohio, the population was about 11 million, largest city was Cleveland, and the smallest was St. George. all right, so just continuing, just a little bit more complicated. I mentioned we can now reshape. So now we want to say what fields we're going to be using. We're going to want the population. We're going to want the, let's get the average city size. And now let's say I want to reshape it. So we've got smallest city. And as I said, we can put that into a sub-object just for presentation purposes. And it's going to be the name is the smallest city name. And its population is smallest city size. And we can do the same thing for the largest city. I believe I actually called it biggest, didn't I? And assuming I type this all correctly, which is a big assumption, you can now see that we now have it grouped interestingly. So now, just getting a little bit more interesting. So we now have it grouped like this. We can now say, you know, we can do some math. So the biggest city, let's say portion of state, well, that's pretty easy to compute. We divide by the total population of the state. So we can see that Chicago is about 21% of the state. And, you know, so one of the interesting things is we can now sort on that. So we can say $sort based on biggest city dot portion of state. And let's say we want to get the largest. So this is obviously the one that's the least. Massachusetts has the is the state where the largest city is the smallest percentage of the state at just under 3%. One of the things I found interesting the first time I did this, I have a bad habit of doing these kind of presentations without knowing what's going to happen. Now, obviously, I've done this before, so I know what's going to happen this time. But what I found interesting is, there we go. So DC, this lists the largest as Washington, DC, which 99.996% of the state, And it also lists the Pentagon as a population of 21, which is really weird. Again, garbage in, garbage out, especially because I don't think the Pentagon is actually in Washington, D.C. I don't know. Anyway, this is from the census, so, you know, we all trust them to keep the correct number of people. So out of the actual real, you know, states that aren't just cities, the biggest one is Nevada, where Las Vegas is just under 50% of the state. So, you know, kind of taking a step back, remember that all that we started with was a bunch of zip codes. And by taking all these steps, and I will just print them out again. So, again, working through, we took the zip codes. We then combined them into states. We then sorted them so that the, we combined them into cities. We then sorted them so that the largest city would be first. We grouped the cities into states and took some statistics on those states. And then we did a project which allowed us to kind of do some reshaping of each individual row of output. And we're now able to get this kind of rich data about the cities and their relationship to the states that they're in. And in 2.6, you will then be able to output that to another collection to do, in case you wanted to, you know, display that in some way. So that's about it, and I'll be glad to take questions.
So you're using the console, or you're using the shell to run?
Absolutely. Sorry, which project?
The R project or any kind of statistical kind
of? The question was, do we use this with the R project? And I know that there is some work to do integration with R, but I don't know its status. I'm not involved with that.
Any images, any image maps or image thingies?
There's no image support built into MongoDB.
Can you, anything that I can add on or
back
to it?
Well, so typically while, you know, when you're doing like hand data analysis, you can do it from here. One thing that you could do is bring up IPython and matplotlib and kind of take the data, have the database crunch the numbers, present it to Python, and then have matplotlib plot those numbers. I've done that in the past.
Can you conditional it all if you wanted to be sure you avoided it by zero error?
Yes. You absolutely could do a conditional here. So you could say cond pop equals zero. If it equals zero, then replace it with say one or, you know, whatever. And if not, you can actually do it all the way out here. So you can replace it with a string NA even. So you won't even do the division. And if it is, then do this. Yes, it is all prefix-y, lispy-ness, if that's your thing. But since a lot of people don't know or like Lisp, I tend not to advertise. Yeah, I mean, I kind of like it for that reason. It's also kind of Lispy in the sense of, you know, code as data, which you can easily manipulate inside your program. You know, it's fairly simple to envision how this is just a series of, you know, an array of hash tables is the aggregation. It's not some, you know, opaque string that you're working with. It's actually just a series of nested hash tables. And, you know, I don't know if you've done programming lately, but, you know, those are structures that are very easy to manipulate and work with. So you can kind of imagine, you know, building up a fairly simple GUI, which I have terrible GUI skills, so I haven't done, but, you know, where you kind of drag the group in and you select the fields that you need or things like that. So you can easily, very easily manipulate these things dynamically. So you're not just doing a static, you know, preordained aggregation. You're actually able to do these kind of grandiose dynamic aggregations. Performance gotchas. So in 2.4, which is the current stable release, we basically did everything in memory. So if you had to do a sort of 1 terabyte of data, you would be swapping pretty hard. In fact, it may just error out. In 2.6, we now do things like spilling into disk once you have more than 100 megabytes of in-memory data. And do kind of merge sort processing on it that way. So so that's just something to be aware of. Also, things like using indexes, obviously sorts are going to be faster if the data is already sorted. So if you have a sort at the beginning or following a match or something like that, it's able to say, all right, well, is there an index that has this sort pre-computed? And then it can stream through. So things like that. You know, it's fairly simple. Also coming in 2.6 is an explain feature. So you can actually, you'll be able to kind of, once you can say kind of, if I were to run this pipeline, what would it actually do? You know, I spoke about some of the optimizations we do. This will actually describe them for you. Currently, the data set has to be starting from a collection. Now, what you'll be able to do is take your synthetic results and write them back into another collection to kind of continue on that chain if you want to write out intermediate results and do further multiple types of processing on them. In what cases would I not use MongoDB? A loaded question. You know, there are definitely some. I think one of the biggest ones is where you have a graph-oriented problem, where you need to go from like node A to node B to node C. So like the friend of a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend type problems, or trying that kind of thing, where we are less strong in that type of operation. I don't know if that'll be true forever, but that is currently true today. There's a question back there. Yes, I believe it's at media.mongodb.org or .com, I don't remember which, /zips.json. So, in 2.6, when we spill to disk, you don't have to supply a file path. It's actually, there's a general temp. There's a directory that MongoDB uses for temp data. But you do actually, I did forget to mention this, you will have to opt in. So it won't spill to disk by default. That way you don't accidentally, you know, run some data on the wrong set, or, you know, you meant to do it over just the data in this small region, but you forgot to limit it. And so that way it won't accidentally just bring your server crashing down, but it will, not to say that it would, but it is a considerably more workload. If you want to do that, you'll have to opt in. And that's just a matter of specifying an extra flag saying it's okay to use, I believe it's allowed disk usage is the name of the flag. We're actually kind of cutting into lunchtime, so I don't want to hold you guys up from eating. But if you guys have any more questions, I'll be glad to answer them. I'll stick around for a bit. So thank you.